Thank you, Ethan and Wendy, so much for helping lead us in worship and sharing with us. A perfect song for today. Thank you. So in 1994, everybody remember back to that if you can. In 1994, a movie came out that still has significant bearing on our culture. It's been critiqued for its treatment of people with developmental and mental delays, and perhaps for its flippant manner of dealing with historic situations. But whatever you think about the movie, a number of its lines have cemented themselves into our cultural lexicon. We use these lines sometimes now without even thinking about it, and perhaps even knowing it came from this particular movie. One of the most well-known lines comes from the beginning of the movie, where the main character and his friend Jenny are only in grade school. There's a scene where bullies on bikes are running after our main character, and his friend Jenny shouts the iconic line that comes up in so many places. Do you remember it? Run, Forrest, run. How many times have we heard, run, Forrest, run, in one way or another? Have you ever had to run away from a dangerous situation? I mean, really run away from something that was dangerous. I thought as I was riding this week, I thought about the wildfires in Colorado right at the end of December. I thought about how for the folks in Boulder County, Colorado, one morning they woke up and the wildfires were not far away, but they were the more rural folks in the county's issue. And within a couple of hours, they received the word in Louisville and Superior, Colorado, to flee for their lives, to run. Because the winds had gusted to such a degree, the winds were going over 80 miles an hour at some points, that areas the size of football fields were being scorched in seconds. People who thought they were safe were told to evacuate with just what they could carry and run. This was no slow, prepared evacuation like when we see a hurricane bearing down on us 5 days ahead of time. These folks ran and drove as fast as they could to get away. When your life or your family's lives are at stake, staring in the face of impending danger, you don't think about it, you run. You do whatever you can to get yourself and your family safe. This adrenaline-charged kind of running is what we see in our text today. This is a story that is not often read and not often shared, but it's one that we need to face and one we need to think about. So the first section of this story, it starts in Matthew 2, starting with verse 13. It says, when they had gone, the they is the Magi, who we talked about last week. When the Magi had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, the angel said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where they stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Joseph is sleeping peacefully when an angel appears to him in a dream. And the angel says simply, Joseph, get up, get married, get the baby, and run. Run to Egypt. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Run. Now, Joseph has heard the voice of an angel before, and he knows it means business. So he gets up. He wakes up Mary. They rush around the house as quickly as they can, gathering a few things up together, some Cheerios, because toddlers tend to eat those pretty quickly and easily on the road. They grab what they need, they fill the diaper bag, they saddle up the donkey, and they run. Now, this is not a trip where they make lists. This is not a trip where they search the internet to prepare for to find the best lodging. They're not using TripAdvisor. This is not where they request that the mail be held. They don't even check to make sure the security system is set. They load up the donkey, driven by a sense of urgency found only in parents that are ready to protect their children at all cost. They ran. Think about it for just a second. What would you do if your toddler child or your toddler grandchild, if you knew that they were under the threat of danger where you live, what would you do? You would do what Mary and Joseph did. You would leave everything behind and you would run. You would run until you were safe. You would do anything you had to protect your children, to protect your grandchildren, to protect your family. But where could they go that was safe? Ironically, the angel sends them to Egypt, which is where 1,300 years before Moses had led the children of Israel out of Egypt and out of slavery. Ironically, the very land that had held them enslaved 1,300 years before becomes the place where the Messiah is freed from danger. Interestingly, Egypt was also connected to the Roman Empire, just like Judea was, except that Herod had no power in Egypt. So Mary and Joseph and toddler Jesus fled 600 miles or so from Bethlehem to perhaps Alexandria, Egypt. Alexandria had a huge Jewish population at this time. So this makes logical sense. We have no idea where they actually went, but it makes logical sense that they would go somewhere where someone might understand them. And actually, it's only 310 miles or so to Alexandria directly from Bethlehem, but you have to sail to get there that way. So logically, they probably followed the trade routes as much as they could. Can you imagine what it was like for Mary and Joseph and Jesus making this journey? Anybody remember or know what it's like to travel with a toddler? Jesus was a toddler. That meant frequent stops to change diapers. That meant eating stops. That meant all of this over 600 miles, not in a car, on a donkey. Thinking any moment they might be discovered. What on earth would make you attempt a trip like this, except that you were afraid for your family's life and you'd do anything to protect your family? Now, you may have thought of it already, but we have a word in the English language for people in this kind of experience like Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. We have a word for people who flee their homeland to live in a foreign country due to fear of persecution or even death. We have a word for that. You know what we call those folks? Refugees. Mary, Joseph, and Jesus were refugees. They ran for their lives because of the threats, actions, and fear for their safety at the hands of a ruthless dictator. Thankfully, there were people in Egypt that were ready to welcome them. Now, this flight, this running that Mary, Joseph, and Jesus has to do brings up a lot of questions in my mind. Pages and pages of questions, but I'll leave you with only three of them this morning before we move on to our next section. First question is, what are you running from? Are you running from anything in your life? Maybe you're running from your past or something going on in your present. Maybe you're running from a major decision or a major change in your life that you know you need to make, but you know is going to be difficult and may even cost you some friendships or some relationships. Maybe you're running from a commitment you made, and yet now you're second-guessing. Maybe you're running because you're afraid of something. I think, folks, at one point or another, all of us in life run from something. What are you running from? A second question I have is, where are you going? I know a lot of people that are running through life very fast. They're being very productive. They're doing a lot of great things and some not so great things, but folks are moving through life at a ridiculously rapid pace. And yet they don't necessarily know where they're going. They don't know what their end game is. They don't know what their purpose is. Folks, getting to Friday is not enough of a means of living for a purpose. Getting to Friday is not good enough to satisfy what God put in our soul and in our core. Getting to the end of the week, there's got to be more about life than that. Where are you going? Mary and Joseph and Jesus were going to Egypt, because that was the place they were going to be safe. Where are you going? Final question I have from this section is, how are you doing at welcoming strangers? How are you doing at loving people that don't fit in? Most of the time when we think about loving people, we think about loving the people we know. We think about loving the people we are connected with through our family, through our friend groups, through our neighbor groups, or maybe through our Sunday school classes or through our church. We think about people that we've grown relationship with and connection with. We think about loving them. How are we doing at welcoming strangers, welcoming people that don't fit in? Think about this for just a minute. Somewhere in Egypt a long time ago, an expat Jewish family or an Egyptian family ran across a couple with a young baby, a young boy. Jesus would have been two or so at this point. They looked scared and frightened and hungry, a little disheveled because they'd been on the run. And this family welcomes Mary, Joseph, and toddler Jesus into their home, keeps them safe, feeds them, gives them a place to sleep, helps them get set up in their own home. And then when the day finally comes that they are able to go back to Israel, this family hugs Mary and Joseph and Jesus and wishes them well. This family goes on through the rest of their life never knowing that what they had done in welcoming the stranger was welcome the Son of God into their house. Never knowing the impact that they had on the future of humankind, because they welcomed a stranger. Friends, the calling of Jesus Christ is that we are also to be people who welcome strangers. Jesus told us that what we do to others, particularly to those who are alone, forgotten, and frightened, it's as if we're doing it to Him. When we welcome the hurting, lonely stranger, when we welcome the new neighbor, when we welcome the new person at work, when we embrace the new person in our office setting that is different from us, when we step out of our comfort zone and welcome someone who talks different, eats different, looks different, we are doing Jesus' work. Because when we do this, we are welcoming Jesus Himself. Jesus is very clear about this in His teachings. Followers of Jesus are called to be the most hospitable people on the planet. Because Jesus says, when you welcome one of these in My name, you have welcomed Me. How are we doing at welcoming the stranger? I hope you'll keep those questions in mind, but now we have to move on in the journey. We have to move on to the really terrifying part of the story, the part that we don't ever tell, the part of the Christmas story we never talk about. Luke 2, 16 through 18 says this: when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time that he had learned from the Magi. Did you hear that? He gave orders to kill every child, every boy, 2 years old and under in Bethlehem and the vicinity. Then what was said by the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted, because there are no more. Rachel is figurative, of course. It reminds us of Rachel, the wife of Jacob back in the early days of the Old Testament. Rachel personifying Israel weeping for her children. God weeping for the children. Herod the Great, who is the Herod referenced here, was a paranoid, narcissistic, and ruthless leader. His government was actually subject to Rome because Judea was a part of the Roman Empire, but they gave him great latitude to do what he wanted. And he did what he wanted in brutal and cruel ways to protect his power. Herod's house and government was characterized by intrigue, deception, and rumors of conspiracies. Herod executed numerous individuals for plotting against him, including his brother-in-law, his wife, although in the course of his lifetime he actually had 10 wives, so we really don't know how many wives he executed, but it sounds like it could have been more than one. He executed his mother-in-law, and he also had 15 different sons, of whom he executed several, all because he feared they were involved in plots to take his throne. He was paranoid and narcissistic, and everybody knew it. As a matter of fact, there was a popular saying at the time. Popular saying went like this: it was better to be Herod's pig than to be Herod's son. Because Herod always was suspecting. Herod attacked his enemies before they could attack him. The slightest hint of disloyalty would send him into a murderous rage. He did anything he could to stamp out a threat, even if it wasn't certain that it was a threat, because he was not going to let anybody get to what was his. He was going to protect his power no matter what it cost. Herod lived his life by a philosophy that has found new life in a popular Netflix show. Maybe you've even heard this. Herod lived his life by the philosophy, strike first, strike hard, no mercy. Herod would have made a great Cobra Kai. He felt no remorse. So think about it. If he'd execute his own son without a second thought, how much pause do you think it gave him to order the execution of all the children, all the boys, 2 years old and under in Bethlehem? He didn't give it a second thought. He was that cruel, that evil. What do we do with this level of evil? What do we do with this? The first question that comes to mind for me is, where's God in all this? Why is God letting this happen? That question comes up a lot when we see evil in our world, doesn't it? Particularly when we see such cruelty, such hatefulness, such disregard for human life as we see with Herod the Great. Now, why does God allow this to happen is a much bigger question than what we have time for today. But we do need to say this. We do need to realize that God isn't the one who had these children executed. This was Herod's doing. Herod chose this. And one of the things that God does to create us and love us is he gives each of us the free will to make our own choices, good and bad. Because part of love is not to coerce and not to control. So God gives us the freedom to make horrendous choices. Now, God holds us accountable for these choices. But the way God intervenes most of the time in our world against evil is through God's people. He has given us, the church, the charge to stand up against the selfish and evil choices in our world that are made by dictators, politicians, executives, companies, neighbors, corporations, anyone. God has given the charge to God's people to say, look, you were created in my image. You've decided to follow my son. It is in you now to stand up against the evil that we see in our world. To stand up in being people of love and grace against the injustice that is out there. So one of the primary ways God stands up against evil is he calls God's people to be the ones who stand and live love and grace in the midst of brokenness and chaos. This makes this particularly sad. When instead of standing up against injustice, churches and Christians participate in injustice. It breaks God's heart. So this leads me to another thought. How are you and I loving broken and vulnerable children? These two-year-olds and under boys, they had no one to protect them. Maybe they had their parents, but when troops come and pull your children away, what did they have to do? So what are we doing to protect children? And I'm not talking about just the children in your family. I'm not talking about the children of your friends. What are we doing to protect children in our city that have no one to protect them? What are we doing to protect children who have no parents, or have parents that are wrestling with their own battles and they neglect their children? What are we doing to protect children around the world who are hurting and broken and maybe not even eating? I'm sure many things are coming to your mind. Some folks are thinking of standing up for unborn children whose lives may be ended out of convenience. Some are thinking about children that are separated from their parents at war, during wars, or perhaps separated at borders. Others are thinking of specific children they know that are suffering from diseases and accidents. Teachers may be thinking about children in their schools, in their classrooms, who have fallen behind because of a lack of resources, parental support, or maybe just due to the emotional exhaustion of this COVID season. Others may be thinking about a child they sponsor through World Vision, Compassion, or another organization. But friends, here's the point. There are children in our community and around the world who are suffering. And we must be about the mentoring, the training, and praying for children whose lives are in peril. Not because of Herod, but children whose lives are in peril due to loneliness, anxiety, developmental challenges, family struggles, hunger, drugs, disease, and so many other barriers, both individual and systemic. We're not called to complain about the state of the children in the world. You know what that means. I can't believe how kids act these days. It's not our calling. Our calling is to pray and act in compassion on behalf of all children, not just our own. But Herod brings up another thought to me. How are you doing at developing self-control? How are you doing at developing self-control? Herod makes me consider this question because he had no self-control over his anger or his lust for power. Ironically, he was very successful according to a number of metrics. He won wars. He negotiated peace. He built great buildings, including the new temple. He had many successful public work projects, and yet he killed people because he had no self-control over his rage or over his lust for power. And friends, we need to remember something. There is nothing more deadly than people in power who have no self-control. Without self-control, people ruin their lives and ruin the lives of others with lust, anger, spending, overeating, neediness, laziness, greed, careless words, pride, selfishness, you name it. We can be out of control in any particular areas, and we can hurt others, and we can destroy ourselves. Paul lists self-control as one of the fruit of the Spirit for a reason. Because none of us should be controlled or owned by anything but Christ. So what's controlling you? In your hardest moments, what's controlling you? How are you doing at developing self-control? Well, it's about time to land the plane here, so let's finish the story. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel. for those who were trying to take the child's life or dead. So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea, in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the land of Galilee. And he went and lived in the town of Nazareth. So it was fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He will be called a Nazarene. Joseph receives word again in a dream that it's time for them to go home. So they pack up and make the 600-mile journey again. At least this time they didn't have to run. At least this time they could plan. As they traveled, he heard that Archelaus, Herod's son, was the new ruler in Judea. And the angel gave him directions, so they went and they settled in their old hometown of Nazareth, in the land of Galilee. Now, interestingly, Galilee was also ruled by one of Herod's sons. Herod Antipas, who becomes famous later in the story as the one who beheads John the Baptist, as the one who will preside over a portion of the trial of Jesus. Why did Joseph go and settle there if another son of Herod the Great was ruling? Well, it's really easy to hide in Galilee. It's really easy to hide and be anonymous in Nazareth. Of course, for Joseph and Mary, it was home, but it was much more comforting to be hidden for them. It's a little harder to be hidden when you're in Bethlehem, only 6 miles from Jerusalem. In Nazareth, they could stay safe. So our story ends today with Mary and Joseph and Jesus receding into the Nazarene countryside, where we will not hear of Jesus again, except for that temple visit when he was 12. We will not hear from Jesus again until he's 30. They recede into the background of anonymity. I wonder during those growing up years, wonder if Mary and Joseph ever looked at Jesus and thought of the children who lost their lives due to Herod's ruthlessness. I wonder how they embraced grace and gratitude at their deliverance, along with their burden of suffering for all they had escaped. How do you live with gratitude and suffering at the same time? It's a great question, because for many of us, that's what our current season is. We live between the polarities of gratitude and suffering. We are grateful for the deliverance we've experienced during this COVID season, and yet we are burdened by the truth that not all have experienced deliverance. We are burdened because many have lost their lives. Many have lost family members and dear friends. Some have lost their jobs and their businesses. Many have lost faith during this season in our political system and the hope for the future. Many have suffered and are carrying deep injury, deep emotional and mental scars. Just like Mary and Joseph returning from Nazareth, even in our deliverance, even as we move on past Omicron and COVID, we will carry deep scars. As individuals, as families, as congregations, as a nation, as a world. And yet, perhaps the most important thing we learn from Mary and Joseph's run is this. In the aftermath of tragedy and disruption, God keeps calling. God keeps calling. Friends, God does not need ideal circumstances to love you. God does not need ideal circumstances to transform you. God does not need ideal circumstances to use our church to do the goodness of God's mission. God does not need ideal circumstances to use us to shine the light of His love into our city. God does not need an ideal world for His kingdom to come. I invite you to ponder as we hear our time of response as Beth plays for us today. I invite you to ponder any of the questions that we have shared. I invite you to ponder the gratitude that you carry. I invite you to ponder with God the hurt that you carry as well. I invite you to open yourself to the reality that God does not need an ideal world to perform His perfect mission, and that God does not need an ideal you to transform you into all He's called you to be. During this time of response, Pastor and Walter and I will be at the back of the sanctuary. If you'd like to pray, if you'd like to chat, if you'd like to consider what it means to follow Jesus, and consider what it means to be a part of this church family. Online, we have a minister there for you as well, so you can share through direct message, prayer request, or what may be on your heart. But friends, however you have responded today, I invite you to use this time to pray, to listen for God's voice.